Well, how are you guys today?
Oh my man, it's hard. That was a good heavy worship set. It's good to get in with God and good to worship and go low. But let's switch gears now and get into the text for today. I want to welcome you. If this is your first time, or if you're new with us and this is your second or third time, thankful you're here. If you've been around for a long time, I'm glad you're here as well. Okay, so I'm glad we're all here today. And if you're joining us online, thanks for doing that. Also, we're going to be in Esther chapters 5 through 7 today if you want to turn there or find it on your device. And I did just want to say one thing about Starting Point before we get into our time together, because we had Starting Point this weekend and on-ramp this morning before service. And Starting Point is just the way that people can go from connected to committed at our church. We had six people in our Starting Point this weekend, so that was really awesome for us. And those people are six people that are trying to explore whether this is going to be their church home long-term or whether they want to make this, you know, their committed family as a church. So we're thankful for that. If you're new, I would encourage you to go to Starting Point. It's kind of the big front door to our church. It's the way that you can step in and learn how you fit into the mission with us here. You can learn more about us and who we are, but also how you fit into the mission with us. And so we make a big deal out of Starting Point because of that. It is your way into our church. You can come to my house and have dinner, and we'll just hang out and talk, and we'll give you a download of all, like a bunch of information about who we are and why we're here and all of that. And then we'll talk about how you can fit in with us as a church. And so I hope that you guys will do that. If you haven't been to one, it's really awesome and you should come. I'm biased, but you know, and it's at my house and all of that. But I hope that you'll make it to one of those soon. The next one is on Friday, December 9th and Sunday, December 11th. And so I hope you'll sign up to come to those on our website at redemptionroanoke.com/startingpoint. Okay, so we're going to continue in the Esther series today. We're going to be in Esther chapters 5 through 7, like I said. And I want to start by asking this question for you, all right? You ready for this? Where do you find your identity? That's a deep question to start off with. It's a deep day, okay? It's a deep day. But where do you find your identity? That's the kind of question that our modern age is asking right now, right? And as Christians, we need to learn to listen to where our culture finds their identity. Where do they currently find their hope? Where do they find meaning or fulfillment? And we can learn to apply the gospel directly to that if we're good learners here, if we're good students of the culture in that way. I listened to a podcast interview of Tim Keller this week. And, you know, he's a retired pastor from New York City that I like to quote often. He's kind of like the godfather of most new pastors, you know. I mean, I feel like he's like Papa Tim, you know. That's how I feel about him. And so he said that when he started back in the 70s, so he's a little older, but he started back in the 70s engaging the culture. He said he really wanted to show people that they weren't good. Because in the 70s, everybody wanted to be a good person. And that's what the cultural moment was. The hope that they could find was being a good person. They all knew they needed to be a good person. And he said that he had to preach against that in a way and say, listen, you can never be a good person. You can never make yourself good on your own. They need the gospel. That's why he wanted to have the gospel show them that Jesus was the only good person. And they needed that to help them be better people over time. He did it for them perfectly. They couldn't do it on their own. But then he said in the 90s, something changed. The culture shifted, as it often does. And he said freedom became the dominant place to find hope. So you're free to be who you want to be. You're free to do what you want to do. And so Keller said that he would apply the gospel during those years largely by talking about true freedom only can be found in Jesus. That's where true freedom lies. And so whatever you believe will make you happy, whatever you believe will make you free, it's only going to serve to enslave you further. What you really need is Jesus. That's the only thing that can set you free in this life. And he said now, as he's retired a few years ago, in the last 5 to 7 years, there's been another shift in the culture because the foundations of the culture is shifting sand, okay? Where people find their hope changes. And he said now, it's not about freedom so much as it is about identity. And that's the language that we hear all the time. How do you identify, right? That's the big thing right now. So he said, if you're still preaching, or if he were still preaching, he would probably try to show people in the culture now that Christianity is the only identity that is received, not achieved. That's how he would contextualize the gospel now. In other words, it's more pressure than you can handle to create your own identity. Because all moderns will say that their identity is something they have to find or perform and achieve on their own. You have to do certain things in order to be who you were truly meant to be. But God will show us that if we simply come to him, we are who he says we are. That's the gospel. You don't have to work for that identity, right? You don't have to fight for that identity. You don't have to protect that identity. It's just given to you by a loving father who wants to give you true fulfillment and meaning. He wants to give you your true identity. And not only that, but Christianity is the only way to truly have an inclusive mindset in that identity. Because when you have to try to create your own identity, or you try to find your own identity, when somebody threatens that identity, what do you have to do in order to keep it? Man, you got to fight tooth and nail, right? You have to justify that identity. And so that's why we have intolerance against intolerance right now, which is, of course, a self-defeating kind of thing, because even if you're intolerant against those who are intolerant, you yourself are intolerant, right? And so that's why we have this. You kind of have to bolster your flagging sense of identity there, your flagging sense of self-worth, because you have to justify the fact that you found this identity. You've got to defend it at all costs because it's achieved. You have to achieve that on your own. And what Keller would say is, no, no, no. That's not how you find your identity. The gospel is the only place for your true identity. Because ultimately what you're going to end up like is the Pharisee who's praying next to the tax collector, and he says, thank God that I'm not like that bad person right there. That's what the culture does right now. It's very legalistic. It's very principled based. But see, in Christ, we can love our enemies. In Christ, it's the identity that we don't have to work for or achieve, but it's been given to us by God, who's bigger than the opposition that we're going to face. So we don't have to be intolerant of the intolerant. We can be tolerant of the intolerant because we know who we are. Our identity is secure. Now, what's all this have to do with Esther? Okay, I'm sure that somebody's asking that question. Well, it's all just free advice from St. Tim, all right? Not the St. Tim that Paul wrote to in the New Testament either, St. Tim Keller, okay? So he's not gone yet, but Father Tim, we'll call him Father Tim of our generation, you know? But the essential question here in this entire book of Esther is getting at, who are you? That's the question in Esther. And if we put it in Christianese, whose are you, right? We love that. We love that language. But who are you? What's your identity? That's kind of the central question here, the central concept of Esther. I don't want to overstate it, but I actually think that Esther is probably the Old Testament book that needs to be applied to our culture today. I think it maybe even is the most relevant book, because God's not mentioned anywhere, and yet he's hidden behind the scenes, moving and working. Where people find their hope today isn't where they'll try to find it in 50 years. And I think that, as we know, it's shifting sand. It might not even be in the next 20 years or the next 10 years that people will try to find their hope. It'll change all the time. But I think Esther can show them something. I think it's maybe the most relevant book in the Bible right now for our culture. We know that our hope never has to change. It can be found and secured by being in God's family. And that's what Esther shows us here. Our identity comes from being God's people. So the main point for today, if you're taking notes and you want to write this down, is the only identity worth having is God's identity for us. That's the only identity that's worth having in this life. We're going to tend to make our own identity. We're going to tend to try to find our own identity, or just outright reject God's identity for us. And we often do that out of pride, as we're going to see with Haman today in the story. Pride is a huge part of why we reject God's identity. And that's what can lead to the state of the culture that we're in now, where everybody's divided, right? Everything's divided. Everybody's fighting. Everybody's arguing all the time. If we're going to have this hope in this life and find true fulfillment and meaning and purpose, then it's knowing whose we are and what we've been created to do and be by God. Now, we talked about this some last week when we talked about purpose. I hope you'll go back and listen to the sermon from last week if you weren't here. We couldn't record the video, but we have the audio. So I hope you'll go back and listen to it on our podcast or on our YouTube channel. We talked about purpose then. Esther was finally willing to see that she was made for that moment, right? We can see that we're made for this moment. We're not here by accident. God is moving and working even when we don't see it. We're made for this moment. No matter what's going on in our life, no matter how hard it is right now, we're made for this moment. Esther was made for the moment she was in. She was the instrument that God used to deliver his people at that time. And she finally saw who she was. We didn't talk about that last week, so I want to go in that direction this week. She saw that she wasn't just a victim of her circumstances. Because remember, she was trafficked, right? It was a terrible situation for her. She was put in a contest she didn't want to be in. But then she kind of started to take on the Persian life anyway. And she started to make some bad choices. So she finally saw that she wasn't a victim. She wasn't even a queen. She was one of God's people. She was one of God's people. That's what defined who she is. And so we kind of saw that a little bit. We're going to dig into that this week. But Haman, on the other hand, who we'll compare this with, we'll see him get knocked down and hit rock bottom here. because he tries to find his identity in the wrong place with the wrong king. And remember Haman's situation from last week. He's on top of the world right now. He looks like he's winning the whole thing. Remember, he's the one that's the bad guy. He's the enemy. And it's been 5 or so years since he's enjoyed the level of power and authority that he's had all across the Persian Empire. But he gets pretty galled at the fact that Mordecai won't bow to him. And he just can't let it go. So much so that he convinced the king, remember we talked about this very easily, by the way, just to let him make a law that all Jews could be killed eventually. And that edict would go out and it would say 12 months later. So they had a 12-month gap, if you'll remember that. All across the kingdom, the Jews could be killed at will in 12 months. Everybody starts tearing their clothes, they're fasting, they're weeping, they're mourning. And Mordecai goes pretty hard at Esther and says, hey, you need to do something. And she finally steps into the moment that God provided. It looks like she's going to go to the king. She's going to do what she's supposed to do. That's where we left off. Remember where she said, if I perish, I perish. She saw her moment. Now, what I want to do today is do a little bit more reading than normal. You guys sound pretty quiet out there, so try not to fall asleep, okay, as we read. But I want you to hear the story that the author is weaving for us. We're going to start in chapter 5 in verse 1. And so this is right after that moment that she had, that defining moment. If I die, I die. And then she said, go and fast for 3 days. And all the Jews were fasting. So that means they went to God. She finally went to the right king, right? She goes to God. And then on the third day, this is where it starts in verse 1. On the third day after that fasting, Esther dressed in her royal clothing, and she stood in the inner courtyard of the palace facing it. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the royal courtroom facing its entrance. And as soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, this is the moment, right? She gained favor with him. Whew. Hurdle number one overcome. The king extended the golden scepter in his hand toward Esther, and she approached and touched the tip of the scepter. What is it, Queen Esther? The king asked her. Whatever you want, even to half the kingdom, will be given to you. And she says, if it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come today to the banquet I've prepared for them. And the king said, hurry and get Haman so we can do as Esther has requested. And so the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. And while drinking the wine, the king asked Esther, whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you want, even to half the kingdom, will be done. Esther answered, this is my petition and my request. If I have found favor in the eyes of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and perform my request, what's she going to ask? May the king and Haman come back to a banquet I will prepare for them. Tomorrow I will do what the king has asked. So it's like she just keeps dragging it out, right? It's really interesting here. Thankfully, she's not killed. So we see that. So she finds favor. King receives her. But what's she do? She slow plays it, man. She drags it out further and further. She asks him and Haman, say, okay, you've come to the party. Come to this party right now. Basically, she's throwing a party just for the three of them. And instead of telling the king what she needs, she's like, come back tomorrow, and then we'll talk about it. So she's just dragging it out, man. What's she doing here? Well, theologians are kind of split on this. Maybe she got cold feet because she was afraid. I don't know. Maybe that's what happened. I mean, remember, the story doesn't give us the motivations here. It doesn't give us the details behind it. It just tells us what happened. So who knows? Maybe she got cold feet. Maybe she was trying to butter the king up, you know, because she hadn't seen him in 30 days, right? Maybe she thought they were on the outs. She just wants to make sure that they're good. I mean, who knows, honestly? Maybe she was trying to be wise, and maybe she was trying to be calculated in her decision here, and she had a plan behind it. I tend to think maybe it was along those lines. She used that same cunning that she used when she won the favor of all who saw her and won the favor of the king that night so long ago. Either way, whatever it is, it creates this bigger tension in the plot because they're like, what is going to happen? What is she doing? Why is it taking so long? But it also helps us to start to see that God is working underneath of all of it because it's kind of like against all odds, right? Against all odds, this is going to he's going to deliver his people one way or another. But it just keeps looking like, man, what's going to happen here? Remember, it looks like Haman's winning. He's the enemy here. He's the bad guy. And he's got all this power and position, and now he's going to a party with the king and the queen. The three most influential, most powerful people in the Persian Empire are all in one room. It's a big day for him, and he feels really good about it, right? That's what it says in the next verse. That day, Haman left full of joy and in good spirits. Of course he did. He's getting everything that he wants. He's on top of the world. He's feeling really, really good about himself. It was just him and the king and the queen. How much better could it get? And as he left the party, though, this is what it says in verse 9. When he saw Mordecai at the king's gate, daggone, that darn Mordecai, right? He didn't rise or tremble in fear at his presence. Haman was filled with rage toward Mordecai. Then he's on top of the world, and then he comes out and he sees Mordecai. He's like, oh, man. You know, you guys ever watch Seinfeld? It's like Newman, you know? It's how it is. It's like, oh, man, that guy. So Haman has a problem, and it's an identity problem here. And on the surface, it's a pride problem, and we'll talk about that in just a minute because we already know he's a Jew hater, so he's a racist. And racism is deeply rooted in a prideful heart. But ultimately, it's even deeper than that. Haman doesn't have a firm foundation for who he is. He's whoever the person in the room thinks he is, right? He's on top of the world when he's with the king because the king's placed him in this position of power. But then he's at rock bottom when he's next to Mordecai, who doesn't respect him or honor him or show him the deference that he believes he deserves. That's an idolatry problem. So what does idolatry do to us? Well, idolatry creates chaos in our heart. Idolatry is a word that people don't use nowadays. It's become a churchy word, you know. But essentially, it has to do with what you worship. And your identity is wrapped up in what you worship. So you could write it this way. You are what you worship, all right? Now, using the term idolatry can make it sound like it's a matter of little g gods in somebody's, you know, figurines and icons they have set up in their house at an altar or something like that. But it's really more about what you devote yourself to. So you have to ask, we're all devoted to something. That's what we worship. Worship is it sounds like a churchy word, but people do this all over the world. All 7 to 8 billion people on this earth, they worship something because they devote themselves to something. We all do this. So you can ask yourself, what do you devote yourself to? What do you give your time? That's probably the biggest one. What do you give your talent? And what do you give your treasure to? Maybe that's the biggest one for you. I don't know. What do you worship? That's what you worship, whatever you devote yourself to. What are you always thinking about? What affects your emotions like nothing else can, like it does for Haman here? What are you devoted to above all else? Obviously, we have to devote ourselves to some things in our life, right? I have to devote myself as a father to my children. I have to devote myself to my wife. I have to devote myself to my job. We're devoted to a bunch of different things, but what are you devoted to above everything else? What's your number one devotion, your number one priority in your life? Whatever that is, it will begin to define you over time. It'll change your perception of yourself and who you think you are. So it could be your career, or it could be the dreams of a career that you want to have, but you don't yet. It could be your kids or your grandkids if you're devoted to them. It could be your spouse, or it could be the desire for a spouse if you don't have one yet. It could be your friends. It could be their opinions of you. It could be the money that you have, or it could be the things that your money can buy that you want. That's materialism, right? It could be just yourself, and you think you're awesome. It could be your own comfort. What is your priority in life? You worship something. We all do. And we all tend to worship something that's not the God that created us. And I think we need to start there. What is that for you? Christian? Jesus follower? What is that for you? Because we all have something that we tend to worship that's not God. We need to recognize those things in our life and in our heart. And the easiest way to tell what you're worshiping is to start noticing what gets you really worked up. What is it that makes you crazy when that thing is threatened? You guys ever felt that way before? 1 minute you're on cloud 9, you're super happy, and the next minute you just go to rock bottom because it doesn't go the way that you want it to go. Just like Haman here, man. He was on cloud 9, he had everything he wanted until he saw somebody that didn't feel the same way about him that he thought they should, right? And then he hits rock bottom and he goes low. Is there anything like that in your life? I'm not talking about mental illness here, that's something totally separate, okay? That's a different issue that we can talk about later, but I'm talking about when you're having a great day at work, and somebody out of nowhere disrespects you in front of your boss or one of your coworkers, how emotional do you get about that? How does that make you feel? Is that the thing that rocks your world and sends you into a tailspin? Because that emotional roller coaster can be telling you something about what idol you have in your life and what you're devoted to. Maybe you're too devoted to what others think of you. And the thing that you worship is threatened. It's going to cause panic. It's going to cause anger. It's going to cause hopelessness, worthlessness, something else like that. You're going to either lash out and you're going to fight, or you're going to curl up in a little ball and you're going to cry out for relief. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't love it when people disrespect us, obviously, right? I don't like it when people disrespect me, but is your response driven by something deeper there? Is there something deeper going on in your heart? When somebody on social media disagrees with you, Do you feel attacked? Is that something you take deeply personally and you got to unfriend and not be around that person anymore because they've criticized you, they said something ugly to you? How personally do you take something like that? Man, when something threatens your ability to get the next best thing, how angry or how emotional do you get when you can't have, you just got to have that thing, man. Whatever it is, you got to have the car, you got to have the coat, you got to have the gadget, whatever it is, and you can't get it, man, it just destroys you. Just makes you feel so low. When somebody threatens your comfort, what's your reaction? That's my biggest one, if I'm being personal with you guys. I think that's probably the biggest one in my life right now. When my personal comfort is threatened, I love my children, okay? But they threaten my comfort all the time. It's uncomfortable to have kids. It just is. They are little me monsters themselves, and they constantly got to have something from you, whatever it is. Even if it's just like nothing, even if it's just attention, they just got to have the attention for just a moment. And that really threatens my comfort. And sometimes I find myself getting angry with them or disciplining them because they've threatened my idol, not because I'm for them and want them to be better people. You see, there's a big difference there, right? The discipline maybe even looks the same, but my motivation for behind why I do it is all wrong. That's what pride can do, and that's what idolatry can do in our lives. When we worship something beyond God, these things can show us what we really worship, and that's what happens to Haman here. When he gets home, he even calls together his wife and all of his friends, and he's building himself up. He's like, look how powerful I am. Look how great I am. Look how much money I have. Look how awesome I am. And there's this guy that doesn't like me. Can you believe it? Right? It's like a little crybaby. He goes home. It's ridiculous. And his friends are like, man, I can't be satisfied. It's so dramatic. It's like the emotional infant that we talked about in our emotionally healthy spirituality series from a few months ago. You remember that? It's like he's just got to have it for himself. He's thrown a little temper tantrum. If we're honest, we all do that when our idols are threatened, don't we? His wife and friends in the story are like, well, why don't you do this, okay? Why don't you make a giant pole and put Mordecai on it, all right? It's just like terrible advice. This is part of the irony and the satire and the humor in the book. It's a dark humor. It's kind of like a dark comedy going on here. We need to see that. Because every time somebody gives advice in the book of Esther, I want you to go back and read it, it's terrible advice. Every single time. And that's part of what leads us to see that God is the one weaving all this together. Because every time we see the advice, it's horrible. Mordecai gives bad advice to Esther. You know, the king's people give him bad advice. Now we see Haman's people giving bad advice. And of course, just like every other circumstance, it's like, hey, that sounds like a great idea. Okay. This is bad advice, but hey, you know what? Maybe I will do that. I am going to make a poll, and I'm going to stick Mordecai on it. Yeah, I'm going to stick it to that guy, right? That guy doesn't deserve to live. I'm going to do this. And of course, in our translation, it says gallows, but the literal word is wooden pole. So since impalement was either a form of torture at the time or a rudimentary form of crucifixion, could have been like nailing him to the pole. Either one of those is probably what it means here. When it says gallows, it means he's going to erect this huge thing and he's going to stick Mordecai on it just because Mordecai threatens his idols. You see? As we've seen so far through the book, that's just, it looks like he's winning here yet again. But again, the plot thickens because this is where the tide begins to turn. This is where we see another change, just another little twist in the plot here, okay? Because there's a seemingly random problem that shows up right after this. He's on top of the world. He's like, man, I can't. And he goes so low and he's like, yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to kill Mordecai. That's the answer. And then we see that the king has a night where he can't sleep. Very interesting. It's just kind of anticlimactic in some ways, but this is where it turns. I mean, the king was in his mid-30s, okay? That's what it says. Said earlier. We know that. So I know why, even though it doesn't say in the text, I know why the king couldn't sleep, because he had a party the night before and he had acid reflux, okay? Now, being in my mid-30s, I know exactly that is what it happened, okay? That's 100% for sure that's why, because he went to a party. He had a lot of alcohol, a lot of things he probably shouldn't have had, and then he had acid reflux. Know that 100%, all right? Even though it didn't say it, I know that. So this is where the coincidences that have been lining up throughout the story start to come into full view of God's sovereignty here. Because as we talked about last week, we can say it a different way, and I want you to write this down. God's plan may be hidden, but it's purposeful. It may be hidden. Nobody knows that God is the one that gives the king a sleepless night. Nobody knows why all of the advice is so bad and people keep following it, and yet God's people are going to be delivered. Nobody knows why this is happening. Oh, but we know, because we're reading the story. We know that while God's plan may be hidden, it's purposeful. He has a purpose behind why he's doing everything that he's doing. Now, John Piper had a quote a few years ago that said, God is always doing 10,000 things in your life, and you may be aware of only three of them, if that, right? God's doing so much in our lives behind the scenes that he's directing your life to a specific end. He knows when you were born, he knows what you're going to do today, he knows what you're going to do tomorrow, and he knows when you're going to die. He's directing it all. It's purposeful. We don't know, but he does. We might not know what he's doing in history, but he does. We might not know what he's doing with our current, crazy culture that we're in, and social media being introduced, and the presidents of the United States being crazy, I'm sorry, on both sides, okay? I hope it offends both of those sides, all right? They're all crazy. And so he knows, though. God knows. And his purposes are behind all of that, directing it, all right? But he knows what's going on in your life personally, doesn't he? He knows what's happening right now. And there's a purpose behind it. That's what's really interesting about this story. So the king, he can't sleep. Now there's a purpose behind it. We don't know what it is yet as we read on. We haven't read there yet, but there's a purpose. And he happens to just go downstairs to his library, has somebody read to him. And they just happen to pick up the book of daily reports just to see what had happened, over the last however long. Because then they just happen to turn to the page where Mordecai stopped an assassination attempt so many years ago or whenever it was. They just happened to turn there while he was reading. And the king asked the guy, just kind of nonchalantly, hey, did we ever do anything for that guy, Mordecai? And the guy's like, no, we never did anything. Okay, well, you know what? I ought to fix that. It's kind of anticlimactic, right? But this is where the tide turns right here, and it starts to shift away from Haman winning, the enemy of God's people, to now God's people start to come into the king's view and his perspective. Very interesting. One of the most ironic places in the book here, the king just kind of nonchalantly again says, well, who's outside? Let me get some advice from somebody in the court. Who's out in the court right now? Well, Haman's in the court, just by happenstance, right? Now, why is Haman there? Well, it's probably because he got there early so that he could ask the king if he could put Mordecai on the stake that he'd erected. He's going to go and ask if he can kill Mordecai. The king has just realized he needs to honor Mordecai. Do we see the tension here happening? It's actually a brilliant story, the way that it's written. So this happens. He's like, okay, bring Haman in. Let's ask him what he thinks. And the king just generally asks, he doesn't say who it's for, he just generally asks, what should be done for the man the king wants to honor? Love this, it's brilliant. And Haman, because of his idolatry, he immediately thinks the king's talking about him. His pride unparalleled in the entire story, right? Even above the king's pride. It's like, man, he's talking about me. I'm going to do what I want to do. What would I want him to do for me beyond what he's already done? I've got the second most powerful position in the kingdom. What else could I have done that I would want to be honored? And this is what Haman told the king. For the man the king wants to honor, have them bring a royal garment that the king himself has worn and a horse the king himself has ridden, which has a royal crown on its head. Put the garment and the horse under the charge of one of the king's most noble officials. Have them clothe the man the king wants to honor and parade him on the horse through the city square and call out before him, this is what is done for the man the king wants to honor. And the king told Haman, hurry and do just as you proposed, and take a garment and a horse from Mordecai the Jew, who's sitting at the king's gate, and do not leave out anything you've suggested. Finally, we have a piece of advice that starts to sound right? Like the tide has turned. It's just so ironic, right? This is like the satire of the book. It's crazy. This is what happens here to Haman. It's meant to be hilarious, but it's also kind of sad, right? It's sad for Haman. And you can write this down. Pride always comes before the fall. This is what happens here. Proverbs 16:18 says, pride comes before destruction and an arrogant spirit before a fall. This story plays on that principle hard because this is the beginning of Haman's downfall. Haman was so arrogant and so prideful and wanted to be so badly above everyone else. He wants to be in the king's shoes. I mean, look at what he's doing here. He's like a robe the king has worn. a horse that the king has, he wants to be the king. He wants to put himself in place of the king, essentially, without being the king. So prideful. And that's what leads to his downfall now. And in the king's eyes, Mordecai needs to be honored now. And Haman cannot stand that. It's crushing him. The fact that somebody else could be honored and not him. Verse 12 says he's mournful. He covers his head and he goes away. He's humiliated. He couldn't share that honor with anyone. Pride will do that. Pride does that in our lives. Pride at its core is thinking of yourself more than you think of God or others. It's thinking of yourself all the time. It's only thinking of yourself. See, in the unbalanced, if it's balanced, the upward, inward and outward life that we talk about here all the time, loving God completely, loving yourself correctly, loving others compassionately, what pride does is it takes that inward piece, loving yourself correctly, and it says, love yourself only. See, it skews that, okay? It becomes all about you at the expense of everybody else. There's constant comparison that goes on. This is what C.S. Lewis says in his chapter on mere Christianity. He says, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. So we say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good looking, but they're not. That's not what they're proud of. They're proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. That's what they're proud of. If somebody else became equally rich or clever or good looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It's the comparison that makes you proud. The pleasure of being above the rest. That's what pride is. See, pride's deadly in that way. It's a deadly sin, and there's four ways that Tim Keller, St. Tim, Papa Tim, gives us that I want to share with you. Four ways that pride is deadly for us in this way, just based off of what Haman's experiencing here. The first is that pride makes you a fool. Like Haman, you can't learn from your mistakes in this case. You're too prideful. You can only see how it affects you, and you just keep justifying yourself. It's always somebody else's problem. It's always somebody else's fault. It's never your fault because your identity is wrapped up in your pride and how you perceive yourself or how you think others perceive you. So your relationships end poorly. It's always their fault. It's never your fault. You mess up at work. It's the system or it's your boss or whatever it is, but it's not you. Right? That's pride. Pride is, it shows our foolishness. But you can also have a false sense of control or confidence because of this as well. I heard a story that I thought was ridiculous, okay? I heard a story, now this is not the ridiculous part. A college guy who's a wrestler and his friend were out hunting in Wyoming and they got attacked by a bear, a grizzly bear. Okay, so that's not funny. That's not the funny part. They were both okay, so they made a full recovery. But basically what happened was this guy was out there and he said he heard this crashing and he turned around and saw his friend through the woods and his friend just getting attacked by this bear. And so he went over and he threw sticks and stones and tried yelling at it, tried getting the bear away, but the bear just wouldn't leave his friend alone. And so he finally did the only thing he knew else to do. He leapt on top of the bear and grabbed it and started to try to wrestle this thing. Well, it gave his friend enough time to get away so that his friend wouldn't be killed. But then, of course, the bear turns on him, right, and starts fighting him. And what's he do in order to stay alive? He curls up in a ball and he plays dead, right? This is what's so crazy about it, though, because you're like, that sounds right. That sounds like, why, who would leap? It's very heroic, right? Listen to what he said in the interview after this. This is a straight quote from the article. I quote, okay? Before this attack, I'd thought that I could take on a bear easily. Who is this guy, right? Now, I know that a bear is pretty legit, okay? Kid you not, it was right in the article. They are tougher, stronger, and bigger than I thought. It's not so easy. Pride leads to foolishness, okay? That's just total stupidity. Who thinks that they could take on a grizzly bear, right? I mean, but this wrestler, whatever, he thought he was all that until he finally fought a bear, okay? And then he realized, no, I got to play dead to do it. I got to act like I'm dead in order. I can't fight a bear, you know? Pride makes us into a fool. That's what it does. All right. But the second thing is that makes pride deadly, pride makes you evil. And I think this is the most hard thing to swallow and the most unpopular. Tim Keller said it. Okay, I'm just giving you what Tim Keller said. It's the original sin, though, right? I mean, it's what brought down God's adversary, and it's what brought down the first humans, Adam and Eve. It's a desire to not just be like God, which is our God-given purpose. We talked a little bit about that last week. But it's to be God over him. It's to be God over our own life. It's to be God. That's evil, guys. That's what's evil. It's evil because it rejects God, but it also harms ourselves and our own self-worth, sense of self-worth, but also then starts to cause us to harm other people. And it makes it evil in our lives. It doesn't just skew how we view ourselves, although it does, because we see ourselves in place of God, but it also skews how you view other people because they're automatically less than you. If you're God, what does that make everybody else, right? But it also gives us two different ways through which we view other people. And we'll either view them as being superior to them, or we'll view them as being, we're inferior to them. And you're like, wait, how does inferiority play into pride? Well, they're two sides of the same coin. You can either feel superior to somebody, or you can feel inferior to a point of pride. How's that work out? Well, because obviously the first one, superiority, you feel like you're better than everybody else. That's classism, racism. It's a superiority complex. You're probably a narcissist. That's what everybody thinks of when we think of pride, right? That's evil to do that. But on the other side of that, you're thinking of yourself as just the lowliest thing. You're worthless. You don't see your true value. And you want to be better than everybody else, but you know you're not. You see how that works out? In either case, you're still thinking of yourself more than you're thinking of other people. It's all about you. It's all about you being the victim. It's all about you not being what you want to be. Guys, that's pride. When you think of yourself more than you think of other people, it's a skewed sense of who you are. It's because your identity's mixed up. It's an identity issue, really. So it's deadly for that reason because it can be hidden as well. And that's the third thing. These kind of build on each other, but pride is hidden. Very rarely do you see that you're proud. I mean, you can see all other sins, right? I mean, most other sins you can actually see. I mean, if somebody commits adultery, they don't just turn around and all of a sudden look, oh, that's not my wife, right? It didn't catch them by surprise that was somebody that wasn't their spouse. It's very clear that you're stepping into a sinful situation. Same with greed, right? If you steal something, you know that you're taking something that's not your own. I mean, you can see that. But with pride, it's more subversive. It's deadly because you don't see the motivation behind what you're doing sometimes. You could still be committing adultery. This is from C.S. Lewis's chapter on pride. You ought to go back and read it from Mere Christianity. That's where it comes from. But he's like, man, somebody could commit adultery because they're lustful, right? They want the affection, they want the pleasure, whatever it is. But somebody could commit adultery because they're prideful. They don't care about the pleasure. They care about dominating someone else. They care about seeing if they can just do it. That's pride. Pride can lead you into these different sins, and you might not even know it's pride. Man, have you ever considered that? It's very hidden, and it's very deadly. Pride fuels legalism. That's the fourth one. It's so hidden that we can even start to use our religion as a way to make ourselves feel good about ourselves, to make ourselves be prideful, puff ourselves up. Because see, the way to fix pride isn't to say, just obey God. You know, put up a bunch of barriers, you know, and make sure that you follow God's commands and then you'll be okay. Because the problem is, more often than not, doing that actually fuels the pride, doesn't it? If pride's already in our heart and it's the motivation, and we say, I'm going to follow all these rules, how does it make us feel when we follow the rules? It fuels the pride, right? It really does make us like that parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector from Luke chapter 18. I referenced it earlier, but just it's self-justifying. It's prideful. This Pharisee goes to the temple and he goes to pray, and he's sitting next to a tax collector who's weeping over his own sin, and he looks at the tax collector and says, man, God, thank you that I'm not like him. Thank you that I'm better than all those other sinners that are out there. Pride can fuel that sense of religious superiority. I mean, there are people right now in Roanoke, Virginia, in our city, in our country, that think because they're Christians and they follow Jesus, that they're better than everybody else. There might be some of you here that feel that way. I don't know. But it's not that that makes it. What Christianity does is it teaches us that we're not better than everyone. We're the worst of sinners. It teaches us that we're all sinful. And it teaches us that Jesus was the only perfect one in our place, right? But what pride does is it says, no. I'm a Christian. I'm a good person. I go to church, so I'm better than everybody else. Man, we're good Christian people. We do good Christian things. Just because somebody is a Christian and believes the right things or does the right things, they're better than other people. Man, you've lost the gospel if that's where you're at. Pride is hidden. It's deadly. If that's where you're at, man, I would encourage you to reconsider today. Pride does that for us. It's what did it to Haman. Haman couldn't see it. He was blinded by rage. He was blinded by his pride. He goes home completely defeated after this, having his idol crushed, having his pride crushed. And as he complains about it again to his wife and to his friends, his wife finally, after hearing him complain, is probably just like, listen, well, your downfall is certain, you know? I mean, I was going to make a joke about wives there, but I decided against it. Just to say she's an encourager, right? Real encourager here. She's lifting him up when he's down, of course. Haman's wife's basically foreshadowing his downfall, though. She's not wrong, is she? She's not wrong. She's foreshadowing what God's going to do with Haman, because Mordecai's Jewish. He's an Israelite. Remember, it's the same Israelite whose God freed them from Egypt so many hundreds of years before this with miracles and divine intervention. It's the same God who established a powerful nation so many years ago through David and his lineage and built the temple and conquered nations and had all this wealth through Solomon and wisdom and all of that. Same God who brought the remnant of Jews back after the exile even happened, right? Now remember, because in Esther's time, remember this, we're seeing they're at the tail end of the exile. So there's a group of Jews that already went back to Jerusalem. It's the same God that did all of that for his people. That's the kind of Jew and that's the kind of God that we're encountering here. And so Haman, man, you're done for. That's basically what his wife recognizes. So she's not wrong. And at that moment of terror, you can see it in the story. Haman just starts to get, he's terrified. He starts to actually see the God of the universe. And this is what it does. Man, when we follow Jesus and we see God face to face, it's like we're seeing our Father, right? But that's not what it's like for Haman. He sees the God of the universe starting to move, and it terrifies him. That's what happens when you don't follow God and when you're trying to be your own God. And Haman sees that, and he's shrinking in terror here, and the guards come to get him to bring him right to the queen for the second banquet. You see, man, the story is just full of all this tension and just suspense and all of this. And so this is where we pick up the last part, chapter 7, verse 1. The king and Haman came to the feast with Esther, the queen. Remember, he doesn't know what he's going to do. I mean, Mordecai was honored. He had to do that. He's humiliated. He wants Mordecai dead. What's going to happen here? Once again, on the second day, while drinking wine, the king asked Esther, because he's not a dummy here. He knows she wants something else. Okay, Esther, whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you seek, even to half the kingdom, will be done. Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if the king is pleased, spare my life. This is my request. And spare my people. This is my desire. For my people and I have been sold to destruction, death, and annihilation. If we'd merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept silent. Indeed, the trouble wouldn't have been worth burdening the king. And King Ahasuerus spoke up and asked Queen Esther, whoa, whoa, whoa. Who is this? And where's the one who would devise such a scheme? And Esther answered, the adversary and enemy is that evil Haman right there that you're sitting next to. I mean, it's just crazy, right? Kind of sounds a little bit like King David. You know, remember when Samuel comes to David after Bathsheba and he tells the parable and he starts talking about that, you know? And he's like, hey, can you imagine this little guy who would, he's poor and he has this sheep that he raises and this rich guy comes along and takes the sheep. And David's afterward, he's like, why would this guy do, who is this man? Well, he deserves death. And Samuel points the finger and is like, that's you? That's kind of what it's like here with Haman. It's like, the king asks, who would do such a thing? And she's like, that guy right there. Now Haman's done for, right? It's all over. And the king leaves in a rage, no doubt contemplating how to punish Haman here, because he realizes he's been duped by this guy. The king finally comes in to know. This whole time he's been aloof. You know, he's been just in his own little world. And finally it's all, oh, that's why Haman came to me the other day and wanted to kill all these Jews. That's why he bribed me. Oh, he hates the Jewish people. He hates my wife, is what he hears here. And then, of course, here in a second, he'll realize that Mordecai is a part of that. And Mordecai, the same Mordecai that saved his life, Haman wants Mordecai dead. So Haman already has two big strikes against him, but then the king leaves, and Haman should have left with him. There was a rule in Persia that no man could be alone with one of the king's wives. And so Haman doesn't leave. He stays there, and he pleads with Esther for his life, which is, again, so ironic, right? He hates Jewish people, and he's having to bow down to a woman. He hates that. And yet he does this here just to try to save his own life. And of course, as the king re-enters, he accidentally falls on Queen Esther, and that seals his fate right there. The king's like, man, how can we deal with this guy? And one of the guards is like, hey, there's a pole erected that he was going to put Mordecai, the guy that saved your life, he was going to put Mordecai on this thing. So he's like, all right, put Haman on the pole instead. And that's where we'll stop the story for today. Haman dies a gruesome death because of his idolatry. You can see these incredible reversals begin to happen here, and all this seemingly bad stuff happening to Esther and Mordecai and all the Jews throughout this book. Some of it is a result of that they couldn't help. Again, she was trafficked. That was terrible for her, right? Something she could not handle. She didn't have any way to deal with that. And yet then she also starts to make some bad decisions on her own as time goes on. Mordecai makes bad decisions. The Jews are making bad decisions. They were put in exile, for crying out loud. And yet we see the reversal. Now it's starting to all be reversed here. Systematically, all those bad things come undone. You can write this down. God reverses the curse over his people. I've got three quick points for you here at the end. It's just kind of points of application for us. And this is the first one. God reverses the curse over his people. Man, it should remind us of what God's salvation does for us. When our identity is in him and being in his family, he will reverse all the bad things in our life eventually. Remember, I mean, this is what happens here. Esther and Mordecai finally seem to get who they were. And as she stepped into her identity, not as a victim of sex trafficking, she didn't identify as a victim, right? Not as the queen of Persia, she didn't identify in her new luxurious life, not that. She starts to identify as what? God's people. And when she starts to see who she really is, that's when God starts to move and things begin to happen, right? When she finally sees her true identity, she gets to see God move and he reverses that curse that was set over them. He reverses all of it. Now listen, that's not meant to be prosperity gospel, right? It's not meant to say that all your dreams and desires will come true now. Everything will be easier for you in your life now. That's not what it's saying here. But it's showing us a little picture of heaven. It's showing us that God will ultimately deliver his people from their worst enemy, not just Haman, but ultimately death, right? God used her obedience and her faith to reverse those bad things that were building up against his people. It's a picture of heaven for us. Eventually, all sad things will come untrue for us if we are one of God's people. We'll get to see our king face to face. We'll get to dine at the banquet table, at the party that God throws for us forever. That's the hope that we have if we follow Jesus. And the narrative pictured here in Esther, we see God never mentioned once, right? But look at all these little nuggets that we have that lead up to who Jesus is for us. Look at the little gospel nuggets that are here. After Esther finally sees who she really is, she dies to her old life, that she's whatever she's allowing to define her, and she steps into her role as one of God's people, and then she fasts and she goes to God. Then what did it say? On the third day, she goes to the king. That's really interesting language, isn't it? On the third day, she goes to the king and he grants her access to the throne. And then as he's granting access and she goes to him, she mediates on behalf of her people in an effective way that the king will hear, right? And the enemy of God's people is shown to be a charlatan and a fool. And the curse is reversed. And the result of all that is God's people are again lifted up and granted life in the kingdom. Man, tell me that doesn't sound familiar to you guys if you're a Christian here. Tell me that doesn't sound like a story that you've heard in your life before, right? I want you to see this, and this is the second thing to write down. In every Old Testament narrative, there's an echo of the gospel. We say it all the time here. We read the Bible from front to back, but we interpret it from back to front because we know that Jesus clarifies all of this. Why did Jesus go into the grave for 3 days? No doubt it was to be the better Esther. He fulfills the role of Savior for us in a perfect way. He was our perfect king, not just a Persian queen somewhere that had a lot of problems in her life. He's the perfect king on the throne forever. And he didn't just use his position of influence and power to save us like Esther did with her people. Instead, he gave up his position of power and influence and died for us so that we could come into the presence of the king, right? He didn't die for his own sins like Haman did on the pole. He died on that pole so that we would be accepted into the presence of the king. Man, that's true poetic justice, isn't it? It's so beautiful. It's mercy. And now because of Jesus, we have access to God's throne and he mediates for us now until forever. Every moment of every day, so when God looks at us, he sees Jesus in our place, right? God hears Jesus because of his sacrifice for sure, but he hears Jesus mediating on our behalf, praying on our behalf because of his resurrection from the dead. Now we don't have to die because of what Jesus has done. He's the king over death. And one day we can be lifted up with him and live with him in his kingdom forever. Got one more thing you can write down and then we'll close. When your identity is in anything but Jesus, it will fail you. And that's what I want to leave you with today. Listen, if you're finding your identity in something else, whether it's being a victim of something, whether it's being better than other people in some way and feeling superior, whether it's in materialism or some other thing, I don't know, you have to learn to apply that to your life. Whatever you're finding your identity in, who you are, what you're devoted to, what you're worshiping, man, it's going to let you down. It will always overpromise for you and underdeliver. And you'll keep sinning over and over and over again, and you'll realize that it's not worth it until the day that you die, like Haman did, and he died in terror, right? But if you go to the right king, if you go to the right savior for mercy, your sexuality is not going to define who you are. You'll get past that. That won't need to be what defines you. Who you love won't define you any longer. What you do, what kind of job you have, what kind of school you get to go to, how good your grades are, what you wear, or how you look, or what you drive, or what you say, or what you don't say, or what you do and what you don't do, whether you go to church or whether you don't go to church, whatever you've been victim to, or whatever you feel superior over, none of that will define who you are. That's what it means to come under the lordship of Jesus. That's what it means to make him our king. None of that can define you, but Jesus can. And like Esther, we can know that we're one of God's people. Not because we have an ethnic heritage or a cultural heritage that's better than somebody else, but because we have a spiritual one now. Because we've been grafted into the family, right? Jesus was the firstborn from the dead so that many brothers and sisters would follow him into life. So turn to him today. The only identity worth having is God's identity for us. And listen, if you haven't believed that today, I would implore you, I would encourage you, I'd exhort you. Man, believe in him. And if you're here today and you're finding your identity in something else, maybe you're a Christian and you've been dabbling in something else and you're teetering on the edge, and I would encourage you to find your identity afresh in Jesus. Get somebody to pray with you. If you need to come down after the service, we'll have prayer counselors down front who would love to pray with you and speak this gospel truth over you again. You aren't what you can achieve. You are who God says you are. That's your identity. Let's believe that today. God, please help us to believe who you said that we are in Christ. God, help us to believe that your identity for us is better than any identity that we could achieve or that we have to work for, or that we have to defend. God, I pray that people in this culture right now, 2022 in the United States of America, Roanoke, Virginia, would start to see that the identity that they identify as, whatever it might be, that the things that they idolize, that the things that they worship are not good for them, and that they will ultimately cause harm to them and to others. But God, I pray that you will break their heart for you and that they'll see that their identity in Jesus is what they've been longing for. God, I pray that you'll do that through us. How else will they hear if we don't go? And how else will they hear about the idolatry that they have in their heart unless we share it with them, unless we point it out? So God, I pray that you will help them to see their idolatry and that you'll use us in a loving way, in a kind way, to show them that they need Jesus and that their only identity can be found in the identity that's given to them in the gospel. Help us today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.